The question was asked, when we see in our day and age that people are looking for all kinds of supernatural things, how do we understand this tendency that in a day that the scientific method and everything seems to be so scientific, how come there's such a tendency to look for the supernatural? So I think that we've reached a point in the development of science and the amount of control that we have, that there's a certain sense of desire for escape. Meaning, if you're a religious person, so then you feel a certain escape. You feel like you have who to talk to when you pray. You're not alone in life. When a person is not a religious person, so then he looks at the world and it's a pretty scary place. And then there's this desire to have a sense, to have a feeling that there are other forces at play than the things I control. If I'm not going to believe in God, then I'd like to believe there's something out there that knows more than me. One of the scariest things you could do to a child is give him the feeling that he's in control. Children will very often push the limits. And if you give the child that he's in the driver's seat, if you're the parent, and your five-year-old child pushes and pushes and pushes and gets away with whatever he pushes, at some point he starts being very scared, because then he's in control and he doesn't feel like he has the capacity to be in control. A child who always gets away with what he tries to do ends up being a very scared child. He doesn't know what to do with it. He becomes a monster. When a child is told by his parents, no, and then the child wails and thrashes, but I want to eat another candy. I only had 10 candies, and the neighbor's kid had 12, and he's wailing, and it's a calamity. And you don't give in. The child goes to sleep a more peaceful child. Because at the end of the day, he's being reminded, I'm not the one that runs the show here. So that takes off responsibility from him. He could wail and thrash and everything, but at the end of the day, he's not running the show. So, okay. We were at the airport and we were waiting for a flight. So one of my relatives took the kids and took them to this arcade where you like drive a car, right? Okay, so one of the kids is sitting and driving the car, and it comes time they call our plane. So I said, okay, we gotta go. So this relative was an older woman, so she realized we had to go, so she started heading to the gate where we had to go. The child who was sitting behind the wheel knew that this is an older woman. They knew they wouldn't get away with it with me, but this older woman, maybe they'll get away with it. So they started wailing. They threw themselves on the floor and started banging and crying, and I said, we gotta go, plane's gone. They know I don't get excited. They could throw tantrums. It's okay, you're allowed to throw a tantrum. Now let's keep moving. What amazed me to see was that as this relative of ours went around the bend, when like the child on the floor looked and saw that the relative had turned the bend, they weren't hearing them anymore. That second, split second, stopped thrashing, stopped wailing, got up, smiled, started skipping. Skipping. I stood there in shock. I was thinking, I'm looking at Jekyll and Hyde here. What's going on here? You know, I understand if they calm down. I didn't understand how in 1 second the kid got up off the floor with a smile on their face, started skipping. They knew they weren't going to get away with it from me. I'm not about to let them sit and play at the arcade now another game. We got to go to the plane. But an old female relative, no, they could try it. It didn't work. Okay, fine, didn't work. Smile, keep going. What would happen if they would have gotten away with it? So then they start thinking, okay, so it's just a matter of how I maneuver my parents, how I manipulate them. So, but then once a child sees time and again that they get away with it, if I only wail, my parents are scared, so then I'm in control. They're not in control. We live in a day and age where we constantly get the feeling that we're in control. And we're scared if we're not in control. But the truth is that to feel like I'm the one in control, when really I can't, I'm not in control. It's a facade. I am not in control. I don't have full control. That's very scary. And so we also live in a day and age where there's this duality that plays itself out. On the one hand, we're constantly playing a game of gaining control. On the other hand, we're constantly trying to do what's right without being in control. So you'll see, even in religious circles, people look for Kabbalists, and they look for a feeling that there's something else out there that will make my big decisions for me. I'm not going to decide who I marry. I'll go to someone else, and he'll do something. He won't know me, and he won't know the girl. It's not like I'll take an intelligent piece of advice from someone. No, I'm going to go to someone who could do numerical calculations, and he'll tell me what's right. Did anyone do this 100 years ago, 500 years ago? Is this the way people made decisions? Is this the way the Torah tells us to decide in life? You could take counsel with a rabbi, you could take counsel with a Kabbalist, but to take all of life and put it in someone else's hands based on something that we don't begin to understand? So that's our day and age. And we see it in many areas where, on the one end, we try to control. So every minute we have our Palm Pilot and our BlackBerry, and I want to know what's happening. At every second, I have to know what's happening in the whole world. Right? I have to know if the dollar's going up, the euro's going down. I have to know what's happening in China and in Iran and in Israel and all over the world. Every second of the day, I got to get updates. We're in full control. Never in world history has any human being had the amount of knowledge that we have at every given moment at our fingertips. Never. I mean, aside from the first moments of creation, where God created a light where you could see across the planet at any given moment. So today we're almost back to that light. We can see it. Any given moment you can see what's going on across the planet. So you look at Google Maps and you can actually zone in on your home and see what's going on at home. We're not far from a day where you could actually see what's going on everywhere on the planet at any given moment. But that same control also reminds us of our limitations. And so there's a much greater desire for a feeling that there's something else here, because I don't really have control. There's very little that I do control. As much as I feel like I control, I see how much I don't control. And I see how much I don't know. And how much I want someone else here to run, to take me by the hand and run the show. And so there's a greater tendency to look for outlets of something I could confide in or something I could rely on that's going to be that God for me. Because if God isn't in the picture, so let me find something else. And I think that's what we're seeing, where you see the secular world looking to Kabbalah, right? And you see in the religious world also, people are looking that way. I think it's a replacement for God. If I don't have God, and I have all this control, and I know I can't handle all this control, I'm not in control, so then who is? What's in control? So let me find something else. Let me find something supernatural. If it's not God, so let me find something else. I think that's at the root, and we live at an age where that's the going thing, that's the in thing. The saying is, if you want to give a lecture and have a full attendance hall, you have to talk about Kabbalah, you have to talk about relationships, and serve pizza, free pizza. That's the key. Wow, where's the Kabbalah, right? But that's because that's what our generation is looking for. That's what our generation is focused on.
But taking this example of the Paul the Artist, it's not because the Goyim nations, they're still very touched to the idol worshipping, and it's kind of something normal for them, for Hindus it's normal to see dry up cows, living cows in the middle of the street, and to think that rats are gods, and therefore they even drink milk with these rats, and they have the house filled with rats. Is that this kind of...
I don't think so. I think it's in Western civilization you see it also.
That's what I'm saying about these bald octopus. People, you know, it seems that they give too much importance to just...
I think it's the need to feel that there's something out there that's beyond us. And if it's not going to be God, let me find something else. There's another point about it. Okay, fine. Where does idol worship come from? So in our generation, I think that's one of the sources of the feeling. There's another thing, and that is that deep down inside, every person was created with a yearning. That yearning is not filled. We spend our lives with a yearning that's not filled. If a person connects to their bon shalom, and he connects to the service of Hashem, the more he connects, the more he can fulfill that yearning. When a person does not connect, so he spends his life searching to fulfill that yearning. We spend our life searching to fulfill that yearning with things that will not fill it. We try to fill it with the physical. You know, we discussed this many times, the Medrash about the daughter of the princess who married the shepherd, right? Okay, so we have a bunch of guys here. You guys know the story, the princess and the shepherd? Okay, in a nutshell, the Medrash says on the Pasuk in Koheles, "V'anefesh lo timale." Mashal lema davar dome. What is it similar to? It says the soul is never satiated. What's it similar to? Similar to a princess who married a shepherd. And that shepherd the first day brings her a hide. So she asks him, "What's this?" So he says, "I brought you a beautiful hide." And she looks at the stinky hide. She's used to the finest silk. He means to give her a gift, and she's all disgusted. The next day, he brings her a pot of oats, and he's all excited, and she's like, "What am I supposed to do with this?" And he says, "I bought you fresh oats, the first pack of oats." She's used to eating the finest cereals. He's bringing her a pile of oats. Every day, he tries to bring her a different gift, and every day, she looks at it, and she's totally disgusted. So the Medrash says that's the way we are. We spend our lives trying to satiate our soul by giving it the physical. So we buy our soul, we buy ourselves a mink coat, and we buy ourselves a Rolls Royce, and we buy ourselves a mansion, and we buy ourselves a swimming pool, and we get ourselves the nicest hairdo, and we buy ourselves pizza and steak and everything delicious. And at the end of the day, deep down inside, there's this gnawing feeling of emptiness. We constantly have this insatiable feeling of loneliness and emptiness, and that I'm not happy. Why am I not happy? Because I have a princess inside me, and I'm feeding her like a shepherd. We have something godly. We have a soul, and we try to feed it with the physical, everything around us. So people spend their lives trying to attain this happiness, to satiate that yearning that's inside of them, but they're not looking up the right alley. It's like the shepherd who keeps looking to give her what'll make her happy, but he keeps bringing her things that are really not interesting to her. By the same token, we have something godly within us. We have a soul, and that soul can be satiated, but not with a pizza or a steak or anything else. All the physical that we keep trying to placate ourselves with, let me remind myself how happy I am, that's not going to do it. So we live in a day and age where we have a lot of physical. We have a lot of good. We have a lot of things, and yet people are unhappy. So people are searching. And this searching is not necessarily a bad thing. But if we keep thinking that happiness is going to be through this, so then, then I have to find something that fits with this. So what can fit with this? Well, if I think that happiness is about a Rolls Royce and a penthouse and everything else, so then what can fit with this? Well, what can fit with this is finding the Chinese, they have these advisors that tell you about auras in your house and karma, and you guys know about this? They pay what?
Feng Shui.
Feng Shui, okay. So you guys know all about it.
And by the way, I ruined your mechonir.
Terrible feng shui. But they have excellent fungus, right? it depends on what type of fung you want, right? Okay. At the end of the day, we don't live our lives revolved around that. But people have an insatiable loneliness and an insatiable desire to find real happiness. And
is it attainable?
It is attainable, but it takes a life of spirituality. It takes a life there where a person can wake up in the morning and be happy. Why is he happy? Because he's doing what he's supposed to be doing. When a guy keeps waking up in the morning and he knows he's not. That's the idea of the Kuzari. Why does the Kuzari begin with the king having a recurring dream where he keeps being told your desire is good, but your actions are not? Because everyone wakes up that way. We all wake up every morning with this feeling, I know I want to do good, and I'm not doing what I should be doing. We each wake up, and on some level, we're not happy with the life we're leading. So Hashem created us with this internal conscience that keeps reminding us to go on the right path. Why is it that you talk to Gerim and they tell you, I came here, and it just felt naturally right? How come people say, I've been at every religion, and suddenly this was it? And you try to ask them to explain, and they just said, don't you see it? Don't you feel it? Sometimes it takes an awakening, and we have to know there are ups and downs. You're not going to wake up every morning feeling this is right. You're going to wake up some mornings telling yourself, I don't want to put on tefillin, I don't want to get out of bed, I don't want to say Shema, I don't want to know anything about brachas, leave me alone. That's also part of growth. That's normal. That's normal. If you think that doing tshuva is about waking up every morning and saying, oh great, a new day in the service of Hashem, you'll have some days like that, and you'll have some days in which you say, I don't want to do this. I want to stay in bed. I want to see my cartoons. I want my cereal. I want my Dunkin' Donuts. I want my Entenmann's Donuts. I want my Burger King, whatever it is you're used to.
Also, there's kosher Dunkin' Donuts all around the
block. Right, and here I don't have my kosher Dunkin' Donuts. I want my air conditioning. Okay, you're going to wake up and there are going to be mornings like this and mornings like that. No one's saying that once you get on the right path, every morning is going to be a great morning. But some mornings will be. And Be'ezrat Hashem, the overall picture, the general picture, is going to be a picture of growth, and happiness is a byproduct. Happiness is not a goal in and of itself. Happiness is a byproduct of a life that's lived correctly. Yes?